Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking, and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
All right, well, we're just going to talk about that then. So, shoulder stability, I think. Probably because I saw a post of some physical therapist showing like a return to play for a throwing athlete or something that was just a bunch of like prone on the table, scap retractions, and like ball, like kneeling ball rollouts on the ground where you're just trying to reach and they're like very rounded with attempt to like get the low traps and serratus to work. It's when I watch these things, I think about like how they're not really appreciating a lot of the things that we would be appreciating, I guess. It's like there's a lot, you can see like a lot of compression, posterior compression is still there, and they're just like creating strategies around it.
Right. I think sometimes the people get caught up in like a protocolish kind of a perspective where they say, well, we have this list of things to do. We created an order in which to do them. And then that's what we're going to do. Right. Yeah. So they're just kind of following the recipe, so to speak, instead of just looking at the individual and saying, well, okay, well, what is necessary under this circumstance?
Yeah.
Have you even reestablished, think about this for a second. Have you even reestablished the relative motions that are available to this person?
Yeah. And that's usually there's usually a big blank look on someone's face when you talk about that, like be like, well, what's the range of motion? And they'll either say like why does that matter, or they'll be like, oh, it's fine, like they're
it's normal.
Normal, like they have an athlete that can like circumduct their arm without pain anymore, and then they're like, okay, so then we're gonna take, I guess I don't necessarily know if this is a structural reductionist thing, but it's like we're gonna take every possible function out of the functional anatomy book for the shoulder, and we're just going to train all of the actions. So internal rotation, external rotation in various planes, you know,
what
like,
does that mean?
Exactly. I'm just telling you what this is.
It's like been there, done that.
Yeah. The idea. The original idea of the podcast being like taking what was originally being thought and used and reconsidering it. And it's like, I think of things like the thrower's 10. I think of things like, you know, all of these shoulder protocols where you're side lying and you're doing like external rotations while you're squeezing the towel.
Yeah.
Like all of these things that were designed to try to like strengthen the rotator cuff, which is just a series of muscles that help stabilize the shoulder in the joint. And it's like thinking that, I think one of the main issues is probably trying to approach every like injury related problem with a strength solution. Like, oh, well, that thing is weak, so if we strengthen it, it won't hurt anymore.
Let's just say this. It's like there's nothing that's necessarily bad. It's a matter of how you're framing it and why you're doing it in the first place. So the classic pad under the elbow, rubber bandy external rotations. So if you say that you're strengthening the rotator cuff under that circumstance, maybe you're improving force production, right? But under the circumstances where it doesn't seem to make an impact, like why doesn't it? Because there's an element that is missing within this framing as to what is moving relative to what. So if I perform that activity and I can create relative motion between the scapula and the humerus and relative motion between the thorax and the scapula, I'm going to be infinitely more successful than if I pin a scapula to a thorax and merely go through the motion. So one of the reasons why you put something under the elbow in the first place is actually to put the extremity into a position where relative motion exists. So if you pin your arm to your side, okay, by definition, this is going to be middle propulsion. And this is actually a place where there's very little to no relative motion available. So if I'm doing this motion, right, with my arm and the rubber band, and I don't have the extremity positioned where relative motion even exists, what are you doing? Well, you're creating an orientation into ER, which means that you're also creating an orientation into internal rotation via the cervical spine, right? And then you're compressing the thorax anterior to posterior. That's not even remotely what your intention was when you started that activity, but that's exactly what's happening. And so now, if we can define what's actually happening during that activity, then we can say, okay, when is this context the best? So early on in rehab, those exercises could be, I'm not saying they are, could be useful in actually restoring some of the relative motions between segments that need to move relative to one another. Now, if you're doing it under the guise of strengthening, okay, and then you get a good outcome, you go, oh, the rotator cuff is now stronger than it was before, so that's good. Not really recognizing the fact that what you actually did with your little skinny rubber bands that produce, you know, a couple of few pounds of pressure, right? What you actually did was you did something favorable by restoring the relative motions. Did you make something physically stronger? Force production by position, but by activity, who knows? But you did something that was most likely favorable by giving them the opportunity to move relative. You can actually learn how to dissipate forces. You can actually access positions that you couldn't access before, because now you have a shape change that was necessary to access a position in the first place.
Right.
So again, not a bad exercise. It's just, how do I construct it to be most effective? What is my intention under those circumstances? Being vague and saying, oh, it's rotator cuff strengthening, that doesn't help anybody. That, like, because that, like, from a force production standpoint, it's like, really? Are you really making that much difference? But if I can move this segment relative to one another, and I can access different positions, and then I can actually put it in a position where the high forces actually take place, and then I can use superficial musculature and I can position this segment appropriately, I can actually increase force production, and I can do it potentially in a pain-free manner. Right. It's like, right. So you did something good with the worst of it, or not the worst of intentions, but with a different intention entirely. Right. So you accidentally did the right thing.
Yeah. I don't think that's happening. Okay. So I'm going to try to like explain how I think that does happen in some cases, uh-huh. But I'm going to also explain what I think is happening in most cases, which is that people are just, like you had mentioned this before, they're just giving someone opportunities to orient themselves to perform the activity. Uh-huh. That's what I think is happening in the majority of cases. Like someone is just becoming better at their using orientation in order to move their shoulder in a way that doesn't hurt. But uh-huh. You're just layering a compensation on top of another compensation. And that may last if you keep practicing that compensation, which is what people uh-huh. typically do. They go to physical therapy long term. They see a trainer long term for many, many years, and they just slowly practice and they get more and more fit at this compensation orientation mm-hmm. pattern. Because we talked about this also before. It's like aerobic endurance and fitness can go a long way, even if you are poorly patterned or whatever you want to call it. If you use poor movement mm-hmm. behaviors, right. If you are very, very aerobically fit, there's some leeway, there's some bandwidth that you're going to be given there. So I think in a lot of cases, that's what's happening. In the cases mm-hmm. where people sort of accidentally come to the right conclusion, where they're mm-hmm. using like quadruped activities or prone on elbows or side lying activities, is they're actually creating a favorable shape change.
Yes.
To get the space back.
Correct.
While they're utilizing the muscles. And in these yes. positions, so like the things that I think about are like, you know, a bear position on your elbows, where you're strengthening the serratus and the low right. trap. But right. what you're really doing is putting them in a position of gravity where their guts have to flow uphill into their rib cage. Mm-hmm. You're allowing them to get AP expansion in relation to gravity and them facing the floor.
Right.
Or if they're side lying, you're creating a shape just by putting a compressed thing on its side and letting it get AP expansion that way.
Yes.
And then you drive these little like menial activities with bands, or you're just doing like scap push-ups or whatever, where you're just driving motion with this shape change position.
Yeah.
And that's getting you where you're going without any sort of like strengthening happening.
Right.
That's not really what's going on.
Yeah. Here's part of the confusion. So when they're looking at these exercises, and I think you know the answer to this, but I'll just throw it out as a question. It's like, what do they use as a measurement tool to indicate the success of those activities?
Sometimes it's manual muscle testing. Sometimes it's range of motion. Sometimes it's,
EMG.
Sure. So,
Okay. So they will say that you do this exercise, and then because their intention is to measure a specific muscle, they will put a gadget on there and it says that there's more muscle activity. And so that implies good, right? Like good is better. But let's go back to, so if you were to look at, let's just say, infraspinatus activity, and you do the bandy thing with your elbow against your side, or you do with the roll under the elbow, or you do it in side lying with a roll under the elbow, and then you think about positions that we discuss. And what you're going to find is, like I said, number one, you're going to move into positions of relative motion. So infraspinatus actually has the capacity to concentrically orient to a greater degree when you put something underneath your elbow than if you were to pin it to your side. Because if you pin it to your side, subscapularis picks up the mechanical advantage in that circumstance to produce internal rotation versus the infraspinatus. So it looks like MG goes lower. So they said that's not a good position to strengthen your infraspinatus. We put you on your side. Now think about this for a second. If I put you on your side and I'm doing the ER, right, on the what would now be the superior shoulder, like the as far as sideline, so the upside shoulder, right? And I put it in the appropriate position. Think about this. I have now created a situation where I can actually access some relative motion, and I can create a late propulsive strategy on the top side under that circumstance, which will magnify the capacity of the lower trapezius to produce ER of the scapula. You will be able to create more relative motion between the scapula and the humerus. I will be able to concentrically orient infraspinatus to a greater degree. So once again, you get this uptick in EMG. And so again, the perception is, it's like, oh, we're making this muscle stronger. Potentially, and that's fine. But my point is, it's like we're making a judgment based on the increase in muscle activity without a representation of the shape changes that are actually taking place. It's like, oh, if I do something in standing and I'm capturing the early representation, then I lay you on your side and I actually capture the late representation. What have I done? I've actually just taken you through two of the primary stages of propulsion. So I've actually reestablished the relative motions and then the positions that I would actually utilize with the scapula, thorax, and humerus to produce force. It, generally speaking, not in isolation of the rotator cuff itself, but I have actually reestablished the relationships. But again, we're not doing that. I don't think that that's the intention. I think that people are looking at it from a reductionist standpoint. They're saying, oh, I have to strengthen this muscle. I have to strengthen this muscle. I have to strengthen this muscle versus saying, I need to be able to position the scapula as such. I need to have this shape of the thorax and I have to have this position of the humerus to produce force or to move, or at least move through. Because if we're talking about throwing is propulsive just like everything else is. It has an early, a middle, and a late representation in all of the extremities and through the thorax. So I have to be able to do to promote those. So it's like, again, people say, well, what difference does it make? Well, the difference is your intention, which means that you can be more accurate with your interventions. You can have consistently better outcomes with your interventions if you're associating it with the right structure and the right movement behaviors versus, you know, just defaulting into, well, it's rotator cuff strengthening.
Right.
Because if that's your representation, when you get somebody that would be, say, non-surgical, like the classic shoulder impingement-y kind of a thing, they always blame the rotator cuff for being weak. When the reality is, it's like you never had access to relative motions. You didn't have access to the positions because that's what the determining factor is. Because people walk around with not the world's greatest force production. They don't have shoulder pain, but they have enough differential in their positioning capabilities that they wouldn't have any symptoms that would be associated with movement.
Yeah. So it's like, I'm trying to think about a way to talk about, so it's easy for us to talk about this from our perspective, because it's like, someone listening in on this that hasn't had a lot of experience listening to us talk, it's going to be like we're speaking a different language. That's what one of the one of my athletes who we did that video series for, the frisbee player, I sent him the videos and he was like, this is great, but you guys like start speaking a completely different language. And he's had experience with it for such a long time. So I think like what we're trying to say is that the what is most crucial and important is often skipped over in the rehab process, in the return to play process, in the movement repatterning, whatever you want to call it. And that is not paying attention to the ability to change shape through the range of propulsion, through the full spectrum of propulsion, which is like an early, middle, and a late. So if you think about like the heel striking the ground, the middle of the foot hitting the ground, pushing off into the ground, and then the heel coming off the ground onto the toe, that shape of the foot is also mirrored in the rest of the body. So we'll have an early shape of the pelvis, we'll have an early shape of the rib cage.
Correct.
If I don't have the capacity to create those shapes through this spectrum of propulsion, something will have to work aberrantly or in a compensatory way. And that's when I can have like some type of failure of tissue. So a biceps tendonitis, posterior impingement, an anterior impingement, an AC joint issue, like all of these things happen because the underlying structure, the underlying shape change needed to move through space is missing. It's like lacking in its ability to do these things that I'm saying.
Right. Yeah. The problem, however, when we're talking about sports in general, is that these compensatory strategies can magnify performance in what we would consider a favorable way. So, you know, throwing 100 miles an hour is a potential gift from the gods on some level, right?
Running 100 meters in 9.7 seconds.
Yeah, but how you do it is also an issue.
You probably didn't see this, but the most recent, like, I think world championship track meet, it was like they were running into a headwind and people were running 9.8. So
unbelievable.
9.7 is coming. Like people, and they keep saying like, "Oh, these numbers are impossible to exceed." And it's just like, I don't know, man. No,
I remember
no
when.
Lyles.
I remember when. Wait, I think it was. I always default like to the Ben Johnson, Carl Lewis, kind of a era, you know.
Yeah.
Where they were going head to head, and I think I think Ben Johnson ran a 9.78.
Yeah.
You know, and they are like. Like it's almost, I don't want to say casual because obviously the performances are still ridiculous, but it's like they're kissing that number all the time.
I know. And it's like that Bolt would let up at the end of his races. If he ran like, to his, if he ran to his full ability, it'd be amazing to see what sort of numbers he could actually put up.
Yeah. But they're doing they're doing these things right. With number one, it's like, obviously as gene pools expand and more people are exposed to different sports, we get the cream of the crop kind of a thing. And then, you know, they get good training and then they evolve. And so that's why we always see these higher levels of performance. Go ahead.
Sorry. Before we go on, I think it would be good to, so what you're talking about is shape changes that in a health perspective might not pay dividends in the long run because it might lead to some type of issue. But when it comes to athletics, if I can create a shape, either be compensatory or not, that allows me to be closer to that force producing shape that I need, then that could be a big advantage.
Yeah. Well, the thing that protects you, right? If we can generalize it and call it health, because I think that's a vague term in this regard. But the things that would protect you from forces and allow you to dissipate too much force or load in one place is not necessarily the thing that makes you spectacular at a sport, because if you think about it, so it, we look at it strictly from force and velocity standpoint. Producing either in any circumstance fulfills the performance aspect of it, because it doesn't matter how you produce it as long as you produce it from a performance aspect. And again, if we use throwing as an example, it's like to throw 100 miles an hour is, like I said, it's amazing, but you got to tie a lot of stuff together. You got to rely on a tremendous amount of tissue behavior, because that's where the energy is stored and released to the greatest degree. Like you turn your body into a giant whip and you snap the ball out of your hand, and then the ball spins and travels at 100 miles an hour. It's like, it doesn't matter how that occurred, as long as the application of force into the ball is appropriate. Right. So yeah. I could do that with an exaggeration of ER and IR orientation, be incredibly successful, but now at what consequence? So there's an efficiency that would be taking place as to how that energy is produced, how you're amplifying the force. Is there a segment of your body that you are more reliant on, say a medial elbow for a baseball pitcher, right? So that stress provides you the capacity to throw at a certain velocity, but under what consequence, right?
Right.
It's like, how many of those throws can you do before you have a structure that gives way, right? How long can your a certain application of force into the ground that we know is going to be an orientation? How many jumps are there in the trabecula of your distal femur at the knee before you destroy the subchondral bony behavior that feeds the cartilage in your knee? And now you have arthritis, right? It's like, how many of those do you have? That's why we don't see too many. I mean, we've had a couple, you know, memorable people that could play in the NBA into their 40s. Right. But it's very rare for that reason, is because there's just so much wear and tear that takes place on the structure that's associated with those activities. Because, again, to produce those forces, you know, there's a compromise. That's why the health and performance continuum is a circle, and it's not a straight line facing away from each other. It's like the two ends meet. It's like high performance is right here, right next to an injury. Right. If I cross over that way, like something gives way. If I cross over that way, it's the highest performance possible. It's like they're right there. Right. Both of them lack adaptability. One is obviously the negative consequence. The other one appears to be a positive consequence, because that was the desired outcome. It's like, I want to throw this hard. I want to run this fast. I want to jump this high.
So what you're saying, so these sort of like performance adaptations that, so for like a baseball pitcher, you obviously need a tremendous amount of external rotations in order to get into position to throw the ball. So you can, I can compress and change shape of my thorax in order to allow me to get into that laid back position. Correct. But what we were mentioning earlier is that arm is not getting into that slot through relative motions. There's a lot of strain that has to go through connective tissues in order to kind of jam it in place. Mm-hmm. Which can be of benefit, because if I tune the connective tissues and I overstretch the rubber band, I might be able to get 101 out of an arm that, right, if I had relative motions, could only throw 88. Maybe. Yes. You know, I'm just saying things.
In theory. Yes.
Right. And then, like, so to piggyback off of that, if that isn't resonating or making sense, it's like a track athlete who needs to run fast needs to be able to be closer to like a max propulsion moment. So they're going to anteriorly orient. You're going to see this in a lot of track athletes. Orient the hell out of their pelvis so that they can point. They're going to try to get IR into the ground as quickly and as rapidly as possible. And a lot of times you will see feet that are flattened, that are closer to that maximum propulsion moment.
Absolutely.
That's like, I think you've called it, I don't know if you called it this, it's the performance foot. I think you actually wrote like an article on this a long time ago.
It's actually a video on YouTube.
Yeah. So the performance foot, which is like just sort of like, people are like, well, you know, like some people, these athletes are supposed to be the greatest movers in the world, and they have like clubbed feet, or their feet are super flat, or they have bunions. It's like, well, that's an adaptation that's beneficial to them.
But see, when you call them greatest movers, it's like you have to define what that means.
Well, no, there's an expectation that they're supposed to be, but they're right. not. So people think that this is some type of outlier or like extraneous circumstance. Like, no, they're not supposed to be. They're supposed to be good exactly. at moving in the way that they need to be able to move.
Right. I just like there's certain elements that have to be present for the highest possible performance. And it's kind of like I said, it's like it doesn't matter how you fulfill those as long as you fulfill them. Yeah. Right. Like there has to be a certain amount of pressure inside of the axial skeleton. There has to be a certain amount of downforce relative to movement and body mass. There has to be enough time to produce force. Right. So think about this for a sec. So you take somebody that let's just say somebody's throwing 85 miles an hour. Okay. And you put them on a deadlift program or whatever. Like it doesn't matter. That doesn't matter what it like. You put them on a deadlift program. Okay. And they have a certain amount of rotation available. And you take away some of the relative motion. And so now the movement is no longer provided by relative motion. It's provided by a elongation of tissue under load. So it'd be like a yielding behavior of the connective tissue. So now they're more reliant on connective tissue behavior to create the shape changes. Well, that stores more energy and releases more energy. So there could be there's a benefit to that to throw harder. So now we got a kid that went from 85 miles an hour to 90 miles an hour by increasing his deadlift. Okay. Now, what did you sacrifice to do that? Okay. So now I'm walking around with a reduction of relative motions, which means there's more pressure and tension on certain areas. So over time, if I had, let's go back to play with our rotator cuff for a second. So if I increase the concentric orientation of rotator cuff at all times because of the adaptations that I've created, so I've moved them closer to performance. So now they live closer to performance all the time. So the amount of force that they do have to produce in certain musculature is tuned up all the time. Okay. So that increases tension on those same connective tissues all the time. One of the greatest, the best way to create a degeneration of connective tissue is put it under tension at all times, because then you choke it off. You choke off its ability to absorb nutrition via the fluid component of that tissue. So you choke that off and now you got a tendinopathy, or you'll have like an issue at the bony attachment. Right. It's like, so that's how that stuff progresses over time. So again, it's like, okay, we got a great performance out of this, but for how long? That's always the concern. And it's like, there's no great easy answer here. It's not like this absolute yes, absolute no thingy. This is why we have key performance indicators that let us know what other changes are taking place. And then we have to make the decisions as grownups, and we have to say, okay, it's okay to move this forward. We're willing to take the risk to move this farther, or do I need to back this off? And then from a strength and conditioning standpoint, you have to say, so Joe Bob's trap bar deadlift went from 450 to 650 and his velo went down. So now I overshot the force producing capability. I actually took away something that he needed. So maybe in reducing the relative motions, I took away the time that he has to apply force to the ball, because I have to consider the impulse. So impulse is force times time. It's like, so if I want to maximize the impulse, I need a certain amount of time. So if I up his force production, but I don't have enough time to apply it over a long enough period, then I've actually reduced the impulse. And again, I have actually taken away an element of performance by increasing performance in one realm. By increasing force production in a lift, I've actually taken away from the desired activity, which would be throwing a baseball in this circumstance. Yeah.
So, and I think I'm going to give an example that I've experienced with an athlete in the past when I was working in like collegiate athletics. You have like a left-handed pitcher throws in the, you know, high 70s, low 80s in high school, really great sort of prospect, like coming up, gets a lot stronger over the summers. Going into college with strength and conditioning program, puts maybe 5 miles an hour on his ball. Everyone's super excited, obviously, because all they needed to do, obviously, was get stronger. Mm-hmm. But as the years go on, by their sophomore year of college, they're not even playing anymore because all of a sudden their trap bar deadlift keeps going up, but their velocity and more importantly, his ability to track the ball has gone away. It's like he's starting to throw slower. He's starting to have less control of his pitching ability because of this like overemphasis on these compressive activities, which might, like you had said, it might initially allow there to be a little bit of more of a springier response from the connective tissues, which is stressful. Like that. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is like the ideal scenario with a lot of athletes is going to be like a management of these superpowers so that you can sort of transform yourself into this oriented being that can throw 102 miles an hour. But after that, can you get your shape back to allow for, you know, we talk about tidal volume, we talk about like heart rate variability, like all of these markers of recovery that we can think about, like you have to be able to have that too. So that is like a very fine line. And like you're saying, it's a very precarious, like,
razor's edge. It's not easy. And the way I always describe it, it's like trying to pin the tail on a donkey with a donkey moving.
Yeah.
Right. Because the adaptability is variable. I mean, all you got to do is track somebody's heart rate variability over time during performance. Like, don't make any decisions. Just let them perform and let do stuff. And you watch these variations. It's like, okay, like every time I have a different set of conditions that I need to try to adapt with. That's why consistencies of behavior has become so helpful, because it's easier to make those decisions. But if you got somebody that's, you know, sleeps an erratic schedule, doesn't monitor nutrition, it kind of hit and miss in regards to activities, doesn't control how much of their performance related time, you know, is at a certain intensity level. If we're not tracking those variations, it's like, it's very difficult to make those. And even in the best of circumstances, the most controlled atmosphere, you're still dealing with human beings, which makes these jobs. And this is why the job is difficult, right? Everybody wants these cool little rules and absolutes. And this is why a principle-based approach becomes so much more important, because it gives me the fluidity in decision-making. It's like, oh, we got to tweak this or we got to tweak that to try to offset some other negative.
Sure. Yeah. And it's, you know, everyone thinking that, you know, working harder, working longer is the answer. Yes. It's like that person that doesn't take care of their recovery. They eat poorly. They don't sleep well. They're under all these stresses, to say like, okay, well, they just need to get stronger. We're going to lift a lot with this thrower. We're going to start throwing weighted balls. We're going to start increasing their pitch counts. Like all these things, like we're going to do more long toss with this athlete.
Right.
Like that is, we were asking you to like reconsider that, like think about, you know, think about your key performance indicators for variability or adaptability. It's like, what are your ranges of motion outside of playing? What is your sleep like? What is your diet like?
Yeah. What's the other thing to, and I don't, we kind of talk about it sort of in the background, but you have to understand that the actual performance of the activity. So if we're a sprinter, if we're a jumper, if we're a thrower, the actual performance of that activity is creating an adaptation.
Yeah.
We have to take that into consideration too, because left to their own devices, it's like people become like they will become more efficient up to a point. And then if the adaptations continue in the same direction, they can promote the negative consequences again. So you think about like a humeral torsion, like up to a point, there's going to be a benefit to that because that humeral torsion could give me more time. So again, we go back to impulse. So it's force times time. It's like, it gives me more time to apply force to the ball. Great. But now if I extend that duration beyond a certain point, now I've actually increased the duration of exposure of the medial elbow to external rotation. And now my consequence is, oh, now I'm putting more load on structures that I really don't want to put that load on.
Yeah.
So again, it's like you have to take those things into consideration. So now the strength and conditioning program, if we're tracking these things, we say, oh, we're starting to gain way too much external rotation. So here's what we need to do. We need to make sure that we're controlling for that. Right. And so instead of making somebody stronger per se, what we're doing is we have to say, okay, we have this relationship at the elbow, we have a relationship at the hand, we have a relationship at the shoulder, scap, and thorax, and then potentially the rest of the body. Obviously, we're all one big piece with a bunch of parts. And so we have to take all of those elements into consideration. So we can't just be talking about like a single structure, like an elbow for a thrower, or an ankle, Achilles heel for a jumper, right? Or the pelvic orientation for a sprinter. We have to take all of these things into consideration, right? So again, this goes back to, you know, having, you know, a profile of the athlete that you can rely on and measure consistently, so we can see what kind of changes take place at certain times.
Yeah. So yeah, and I'm going to relate what you said back to. So Bill's talking about impulse and the time at which force is applied. So harking back to the example of like athletes getting stronger, you know, their numbers going up in the gym, the amount of reps that they can do of certain exercises going up. All of this accumulates time under tension. So if I'm able to take, you know, if I'm able to lift a lot heavier of a weight, that is usually going to require me to exert force into the weight to move it over longer periods of time, and usually in not very advantageous positions, and usually in positions in which I'm very compressed. My entire body is very compressed. So an example would be like a trap bar deadlift or a back squat, something where, or like a pull-up, something where a large percentage of my body is squeezing very hard at the same time over long periods. So yeah, like initially you can only do 2 pull-ups and now you can do 25. But if you're doing 25 pull-ups, I'm squeezing the system the entire time I'm in that 25 pull-up set. So yes, you are way stronger, but you are adding this force over a longer period of time, which can have negative secondary consequences.
Yeah. Yeah, the goal with training for performance is to improve the performance of the desired activity, not necessarily just to maximize the performance in the supplementary activity, right?
Yeah.
So if being able to do 10 chin-ups improves your ability to run fast and jump high, and you get up to 20, and that can actually have the negative secondary consequence now, because now it's too much of a good thing for the chin-up performance, but it doesn't enhance the
right.
The end desired outcome for the activity of performance.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Like that's what strength conditioning is supposed to make you better at something else, not to make you better at strength and conditioning.
Right. Yeah, it's like these general qualities that need to be good enough. Because it's like if you yes. have, it's always like an argument to have with strength and conditioning coaches. Like if you have an incredibly talented player on your team, like don't get in their way. Like use what you're doing in the gym as a supplement too. So maybe they're not doing a lot of the things that the other teammates are doing, but they're like, they're very good at the sport. Like don't mess that up.
Yeah. There's some people that are just great.
Yeah,
as they are, and you don't need to do a whole lot, right?
Yeah,
you just need to make sure that they're not going too far in any direction. It's like just kind of keep them where they are. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, unless your sport involves pushing on the ground for over long periods of time, like if you're a sumo wrestler or a linebacker, or you right. you push sleds in the field for a living, like your training needs to have some. Like the majority of your training needs to approximate this bounciness, this like impulse
right.
of activity. Yes. Like there always needs to be some constant of that in your training. And it's like
right.
sprinting is always going to be important. Sprinting drills are always going to be important. Throwing things and catching things and oscillatory movements that Bill uses in some of his programming. Like mm-hmm. that stuff is important because you got to be able to turn the things on and off and not just like push on the ground for a long time and squeeze, right. squeeze over a long time.
Yeah. Cause you think about an activity. Okay. So, you think about like sprinting, which, you know, if you're on the ground for like a 10th of a second at top speed.
Yeah.
Right. So up to a certain point, increasing force production will be helpful. But if I'm only able to apply force, you know, for a 10th of a second and I increase force producing capability and I magnify the duration of that force application for too long, I can slow somebody down.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're back, because they're the back squatting.
Change. Well, the shape change required to do let's just use back squat. Yeah. Since you brought it up,
yeah.
The shape change required to increase the force production in back squat is detrimental to the shape change that I need for sprinting. That's, sure. that's where that comes into play. It's not an absolute. It's not like, okay, they have extra force production and they just can't use it. Okay, that's true. They can't use it because the duration of the activity happens too fast for them to apply the full capability of their force production. But what did you sacrifice for that increased force production? If I take away the shape and I take away some position or shape or relative motion that I needed for that performance, now you've interfered with performance.
Yeah. And then you have you have coaches and trainers who are starting to they realize that in season, a track athlete jump squats and high box squats seem to serve them really well. It's because the shape change required for those activities is closer, approximates the shape change they need in the sport.
Yes. Yes.
The full ass to grass back squat was never really a goal unless you want to be good at full ass to grass back squats. If that's your sport. But other than that, there's no need to try to jam a square peg into a round hole because it's stronger is better.
Right.
Okay. I mean, it started as a shoulder stabilization. I don't even know what to call this. I'm glad the Riverside AI will give me some title recommendations.
Oh, there you go. So
the future of AI. I don't know what.
It was still good.
Yeah, it was pretty good. I'm just thinking of things we could. What were your favorite TV? Did you ever eat TV dinners when you were growing up?
Oh my gosh, Salisbury steak and French fries, hands down, Salisbury steak and French fries.
Was that Stouffer's? What was the brand? Do you remember?
Probably it was you know how the Hungry Man would have five segments in it in the tray.
Yeah, yeah.
This was straight up two. It was a Salisbury steak and French fries, and I could have eaten a thousand. It was so good.
Yeah.
This was the stay at home mom until we got old enough to take care of ourselves kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And so then it was like, okay, she started to get part-time gigs and then she has a sewing business out of the house. And so she was always busy and she's like, okay, you know how to warm up the stove and stuff like that back in the olden days before the microwave. And
Original TV dinners were in aluminum, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. You had to put them in the oven.
Oh, man. But I could eat one right now. It was good.
It's so funny. It's Salisbury steak is something that you only really get in cafeterias and TV dinners.
I have no idea what it is, but it was amazing.
Yeah. Yes. It's ground beef, but worse quality beef. Yeah. When I was, because you're 40 years older than I am. I was a little kid and you were in your 30s, we had kid cuisine.
Oh,
it had a little cartoon penguin, and uh-huh. every meal it came with had all the sections. It was microwavable, and it always had a treat to it. That was those are the cool ones that we always, because there was commercials for them too.
Yeah.
So if you have, I would also the international folks that are watching this, if they had anything like that, if they had TV dinners.
That's a really good. That's a really good question. I would think they would.
If you lived in Germany or Austria or France or something, did you guys have TV dinners 20, 30 years ago?
I'm so hungry for one of those right now.
Salisbury steak and crinkle
cut French fries and Salisbury steak in.
Well, if it was in the oven, in an
aluminum tray. Yeah.
You just burn your hands trying to grab it out of there.
Yes.
You can watch your Brady Bunch episodes.
Salisbury steak. But see, I was watching Brady Bunch in real time, like episode to episode. It's not like on the streaming
syndication.
Yeah, syndication.